question of the formation of globular clusters at high redshift is obviously an issue that people have been speculating about for many years, theoretically. It's still well beyond the reach of direct observations, of course. What is actually new in this field, though, what I'll be focusing on in the last few minutes of the talk, is the fact that we now are in a situation where we can do the first sort of cosmological-type simulations which have sufficient resolution to be able to get down to the sort of scales of globular clusters. So this is really something very new, and because it's new, I'm going to be asking far more questions of these simulations than they can provide answers of at the moment. So we're going to leave it rather up in the air with lots of question marks. And as a result, a lot of this talk will be setting out really the sort of main observational goalposts that such models have to satisfy. Now, most people in this audience will have heard these observational goalposts many times, of course, so I don't want to dwell on the evidence for it, but I want to state what these goalposts are and angle the discussion towards how hard or otherwise it's going to be for these cosmological models to satisfy them. But let's start first with something much less controversial, which is that globular clusters indeed do form at high redshift. And this is a compilation from a recent paper by Ganadin et al. They say for a given age of globular cluster, I'll get my stick here, if you assume globular clusters are a certain age, and then you want them to form at a certain redshift, and you assume a cosmology, what does that imply for the age of the universe? And shown here are observational limits on the ages of old globular clusters from Chaboyer and collaborators, and favourite values for the Hubble time based on currently popular cosmologies, and where they intersect, you get the box of allowed parameter space and allowed formation redshifts. You'll see it doesn't actually constrain things very much. If I just overlay this with where the current models would be placed on this diagram, of course, you want your globular clusters to be younger than the universe. Everything's got to fall above this dotted line here, but it can accommodate things in principle formed very close to the beginning of the universe, such as the old Peebles and Dickey argument. Models by Volker Brom and myself, which I'll be discussing later, place globular cluster formation prior to the epoch of cosmological reionization at a fiducial value of around 7. So in this sliver here, Sen's model places it at the epoch of reionization, so along the Z equals 7 line. The Fall and Reese argument puts globular clusters forming during the virialization of large halos such as the Milky Way, so that happens somewhat later, redshift of 3 or less. But all of them pass through this box, so actually we get very little constraint in redshift space. Now, it was always popular to classify globular cluster formation models according to whether they were pre-galactic, proto-galactic, or post-galactic. In a hierarchical model, you have to be a bit careful about what you mean here. And something that I'll be discussing quite a lot later is the notion, currently popular notion, that you may form globular clusters in small dwarf galaxies up here, and then through hierarchical merging, assimilate them down in a large galaxy at the current time. Obviously, such a scenario is proto-galactic for the host dwarfs, but pre-galactic in terms of the final product. Now, one of the reasons why such models are quite popular at the moment is that a lot of the properties of globular clusters seem remarkably blind to the luminosity and Hubble type of the galaxies in which they find themselves. Things like their masses, their radii, their velocity dispersions, etc. And so, of course, if you form them all back here and then merge them later, they're not going to know what kind of structures they're going to end up in, and therefore this sort of chimes with this general feature of globular clusters. Mm-hmm. However,
if you put several globular clusters in one of the small heads at the top, does the probability of
actually getting merged? Does globular cluster formation influence the probability of merging?
No.
Well, in such a merger tree, it's all to do with the over density of the region in which the area finds itself, how likely it is to get merged. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. But you also have to think about the density of things around you. So you have to think about the correlations between the density peak in which your globular cluster is forming and the surrounding density peaks. I mean, really, these sorts of things have to be actually milled through semi-analytic models to actually find an answer to that question. I know some people like Rachel Somerville are in the process of doing that, so I can't give you a definitive answer on that, but that's the sort of stuff that needs to be done. However, although I might posit that everything just gets formed there and then merged up, there's a lot of evidence that that can't be the whole story, because not all properties of the globular clusters are blind to the luminosity of the host. And an obvious example of that are the metallicity distributions of globular clusters. And this is a nice compilation of a recent paper by Cote et al. What's plotted here, just forget about everything apart from the filled dots, which are observations. So this is in theory units mass versus metallicity, and apparently there's a correlation between the two. These plots over here are the metallicities of the low Z peak, the high Z peak, and the unimodal peak of early type galaxies. These are the mean metallicities of globular cluster populations of dwarf spheroidals. And your eyeball clearly tells you that you can't just merge a bunch of these and get those. Now, Sen has argued recently that, in fact, in a way you can, it's just a sort of statistical artifact. And I don't know if any of you in the audience have done this calculation. I haven't myself. But my guess would be that you can't just invoke statistics. And what I mean specifically by this is that you've got about 5,000 globular clusters contributing to this distribution here. This is data from Kundu and Whitmore. And if Sen was right, what he'd just be saying is that when you sample globular clusters in dwarf galaxies, you don't get many data points, and so you can just be only sampling the bottom end of the distribution because you don't have enough data points to fully span the distribution. But there are a number of tens of globular clusters involved in these points, and although I haven't done the KS test, I'd find it pretty unlikely that if you selected, say, 50 globular clusters randomly from this distribution, you'd really find them all lying down in this range. So my impression from this is that we have to take this seriously, and that there is indeed a correlation between the metallicity of globular clusters and the mass of the hosts in which they find themselves. Now, that doesn't mean to say we have to throw out the merging picture altogether, and Cote et al. Have proposed a sort of halfway house picture in which you have globular clusters forming in protogalactic fragments, but they're not all very low mass, low luminosity objects down here. They have a range of masses and a range of luminosities represented by the objects lying on this line, and then you allow dissipationless merger to mix all these together, and you manage to reproduce these observed statistics of metallicity versus mass in early type galaxies pretty well by using that method. But I think the bottom line is you can't all form them in metal poor small systems. Now, another classic argument that you can't just do dissipationless merging is the old result that the specific frequency of globular clusters is much higher in early type galaxies than in disk galaxies, and therefore if you wanted to form an elliptical galaxy by hitting together two spirals, you'd have to argue that there was additional cluster formation associated with the merging process. Now again, you may be able to get around this in different ways. For example, if there's some kind of correlation between, a luminous early type galaxy would tend to be formed in a region with a high cosmic overdensity, and if there's some correlation between regions of high sigma fluctuations and some physical property such as the spin parameter, as Sen has suggested, and if that spin parameter itself is associated with the efficiency of globular cluster formation, then you may still be able to get away with ending up with a higher SN in early type galaxies still through this dissipationless merger picture. But this isn't particularly well developed, this idea. And finally, the most obvious example that you don't form everything in dwarfs is just the direct observation of objects like the antennae, that you have merging galaxies at low redshift and plenty of massive globular type clusters currently forming. And of course, after the coffee break this morning, we'll be hearing a lot about these from Francois and Bruce. Now, why this is so important is it provides a halfway house, because we can compare what we see there in the antenna with local regions of star formation, clusters that are forming at a few hundred parsecs from us, which we can observe very well. And then when we make up our theories of globular cluster formation at high redshift, we can ask the question of whether it follows what we see in the antenna and locally, or whether we have to invoke different physics. There's no reason why we shouldn't invoke different physics, but we should be clear in our minds as to why we do so. So in the next few minutes, I'm going to run through a whole series of observational goalposts which these models have to satisfy. Later I will run through what the cosmological simulations are producing and how well they're able to satisfy these. And one basic property of globular clusters, of course, is they've got two mass scales. Everybody worries about getting the mass scale of the parent cluster there, but you also have to make sure that you get the mass scale of the stars themselves. And because globular clusters are populous, these are separated by many, many orders of magnitude. And whenever you have a problem involving gravitational collapse, you want to, it's tempting to invoke a Jeans mass scale. And over the years, different authors have either associated that Jeans mass scale with the masses of the stars themselves or with the mass of the parent cluster. So models in that former category, where you put the Jeans mass as being the cluster mass scale, ones such as the Peebles and Dickey one or the more recent Fall and Reese argument, in the latter case, you're saying that this is a Jeans mass associated with the virial pressure in the forming Milky Way and a temperature of 10 to the 4K in a thermally unstable interstellar medium. Having picked out the right mass scale for your parent globular cluster by that method, you then have the problem for these models of how you get the stellar mass scale. You've got to fragment into a very large number of pieces. And it's now known from simulations of cluster formation at low redshift, where you can get very good resolution these days, that getting fragmentation is a pretty hard thing. It's not just enough to satisfy the classic Riesz-Ostreicher criterion that the thing must be able to cool on less than its dynamical time. You really have to start off with really a rather rich array of non-linear density structure in order to get something to fragment on a dynamical time. And then the worry with these class of models is that if this parent cluster is a thermally supported object, so it's been sitting in hydrostatic equilibrium for a while, imprinting the mass scale of 10 to the 6 solar masses, it's likely to be rather smooth. And then the worry is how you would manage to achieve the subsequent fragmentation during the collapse. I'm not saying it's impossible, I'm just saying that's the sort of issue that is a worry for this class of models. On the other hand, if you say that the Jeans mass is actually the mass of the stars instead, and there's been a lot of work done in recent years arguing that in fact globular cluster formation is a scaled up version of what we see in giant molecular clouds, then certainly in giant molecular clouds, the thermal Jeans mass in the dense gas in giant molecular clouds is not telling you about cluster formation, it's telling you about the mass scale of individual stars. And the size scale of the parent giant molecular cloud and the clusters that form in it have got nothing whatsoever to do with thermal pressure. Thermal pressure is a very minor contributor to the energy density inside giant molecular clouds. So if you say that the Jeans mass is the stellar mass, obviously you've got your stellar scale put in, but then you have to ask the question of how you get your cluster scale out. I'm not sure we know the answer to that locally either. I've described it here in inverted commas as dynamic potentials, and I've got a hand-wavy picture of a clumpy medium going through spiral arms, and where you form your clusters is really a question of what falls where in that medium. Bruce will be talking about this a lot more, I suspect, after the coffee break. But clearly, that's the issue that you have to answer in this class of models. You've got the stellar scale, but how do you determine what forms, what the mass scale of the parent cluster is?
In the antennae, for example, I think it's been pretty clearly established by Mike Paul and Jang that the mass function is a power law. It doesn't actually have a scale.
Yes, that's my next view graph. Okay. Yeah. Shall I just go ahead and give it? Because, I mean, of course, that's the obvious extension. Thank you for following on, Steve. Great. So, indeed, Paul and Zhang. So, one of the aspects which supports a general picture that globular cluster formation is a scaled-up version of what happens in giant molecular clouds is the fact that the mass distribution really follows the mass distribution of what you see for molecular clouds and clumps within molecular clouds. So this is indeed the mass function for the antennae. And when you look at the Milky Way, although it looks very different, you can explain most of those differences by survival arguments. In other words, the erosion of the lower mass clusters by dynamical effects in the parent galaxy. However, and I apologize here because I mislaid my view graph, so I actually have to trace this by hand this morning, but I thought it was important enough to warrant that. There is one thing that we need to bear in mind. This is from Forman and Zhang. This is the observational data for Milky Way globular clusters. This is starting off with a power law scale-free mass function the time t equals zero in the Form and Zhang models, and then evolving them, snapshots at different times, you get to the present day, and you get the low luminosity tail just fine, but you're overproducing vastly the number of clusters at high mass. So it really seems that it's not just a survival argument, you actually need to have something which is cutting off the intrinsic at birth mass function of globular clusters in the Milky Way at around the 10 to the 7 solar mass value. And that is an observational fact which will come back to haunt us later on in the talk.
No.
Sure. Yeah, and I'm not saying I'm not actually myself pushing the argument that they should be the same. I'm just saying that that similarity of slope has led people to make that analogy. But I'll tell you to later on about why there may indeed well be other analogies that you could make which can just as well give you that mass slope.
Well, clusters are going to be outside the cavity.
That's true also. That's very true. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So then, going on pursuing the analogy, and I've just borrowed this interesting argument from a recent paper by Ashman and Zepf, if you look at comparing protoglobular clusters and giant molecular clouds, they span the same sort of dynamic range of masses, but their sizes are very different. GMCs are much fluffier than protoglobular clusters have to be, and they have very different star formation efficiencies. We know the star formation efficiency in globulars, of course, mainly from the criterion that we have to keep them bound, and we know this from observation and the fact that we don't want to overproduce the star formation rate in the galaxy by many orders of magnitude. The fact that each GMC can only convert a few percent, a few tenths of a percent of its mass into stars, and the rest has to be somehow dispersed by some kind of feedback mechanism. So the question here, we've got two differences. Are they in some way causally related? Well, you could put that argument two ways round. One, you could ask, supposing we've got more efficient feedback in giant molecular clouds, they're higher metallicity objects after all, could that actually be the reason why giant molecular clouds are fluffier? Well, the answer to that is not, because in fact, if you look at giant molecular clouds that are not currently forming stars, they have the same mass-radius relationship as the ones that are forming stars. Another way of putting it is the feedback from the star formation is not what is supporting and giving the mass-radius relationship of giant molecular clouds. But instead you can turn it around and say, well, given you've got two structures which have got very different sizes, if you've got a compact protoglobular cloud, that obviously means a shorter dynamical time. The dynamical time is a lower limit for this sort of correlation time between star formation in different clumps within your protocloud. If you've got a short dynamical time, you can get your star formation really very synchronized and get everything into stars really before your feedback from winds or ionizing radiation, supernovae, whatever, have had time to get going. And this is an argument proposed by Ashman and Zepf. But if you accept this argument, that it's the compactness which leads to the high efficiency, then you have to ask, where does the compactness come from? And again, Ashman and Zepf have suggested that if you take a giant molecular cloud and put it into the kind of pressure regime that you find in interacting galaxies, a high pressure interstellar medium, they would indeed be compressed to these kinds of sizes. Another observational goalpost is that you don't want to end up with any model which has lots of dark matter in the globular cluster. I mean, it's been known for a long time that the mass to light ratios in globular clusters, just by fitting King models, etc., can't really deviate much from what you'd expect for the low mass stellar population that you actually see. But there was a belief that maybe outside the optical radius of the galaxy, they were embedded in massive dark halos, rather in the way that dwarf galaxies have dark halos. I think Ben Moore did quite a convincing job a couple of years ago in disproving that by looking at the tidal tails that are seen in certain globular clusters and arguing that, well, you can reproduce these tidal tails if you just put a baryonic cluster with a mass to light ratio of 1 in the requisite tidal potential. But if you start embedding this globular cluster inside a dark halo and cranking up the mass to light ratio globally, then you start suppressing the formation of the tidal tails, and by the time you've got a mass to light ratio up to about 3, then you're not able to generate the such tails. So this is an argument that not only do you not have a dynamically significant component of dark matter, I'm not saying no dark matter, but I'm not saying it's not dominating the mass budget inside the cluster, we also don't want it a significant containing halo for the cluster. And two final little things on the, rather important things on the metallicity, two more observational goalposts. Globular clusters are not population 3 objects. They really don't go down much below 2 decks below solar. And so if you have a model which is happy forming these clusters from population, from unenriched material, you have to worry about where the population 3 globular clusters are, because we don't see them. And the other thing is that we know very well that the giant branch is very narrow in globular clusters, and this implies you don't get a large internal metallicity spread within globular clusters, and so you don't get significant self-enrichment and multiple generations of star formation within the clusters. So it's hard to argue that you start with unenriched material and then end up with, you know, two decks below solar or whatever through self-enrichment within the cluster. You actually want to start off with fairly enriched gas to start off with. And obviously the self-enrichment constraint is another constraint on wanting efficient star formation in globular clusters. You want the first generation to mop up most of the gas rather than having multiple generations. And again, that's consistent with the fact that you also want to keep these objects being bound. So just to sum up where we got to on the observations, a successful globular cluster formation scenario has to make clusters which are popular, so you have to get those two mass scales out of it. They've got to be compact, and we might argue that compactness has knock-on effects for the efficiency of star formation inside them. We want them to be chemically homogeneous, but we don't want that to go down much below 10 to the minus 2 solar. We've got to get the right masses for the stars out of it. I mean, we take it for granted that they're made of normal stars, but we don't want to make a cluster where the characteristic mass scale is 50 or 100 solar masses. And we don't want that dark matter to play any detectable role in their dynamics at the present time. So as I say, these cosmological simulations of globular cluster formation are really in their infancy at the moment. And I think the first one came from Weil and Pudritz a couple of years ago. They were simulating what by cosmological standards are rather modest size galaxy. So about 10 to 11 solar masses in baryons. Starting just from standard cold dark matter and initial conditions, mixture of baryons and dark matter, evolving it through to a redshift of 1. And what their particular motive for doing this was for identifying bound gas clouds that were created in these simulations. Remember, gas clouds are not put in, it's just CDM fluctuations imprinted on both the baryons and the dark matter. And then gravitational dynamics does the rest. But at each redshift, they look at the complement of bound gas clouds that you get out. They identify these not as globular clusters, for reasons I'll mention in a moment, but as the progenitor supergiant molecular clouds in which globular clusters might form. Now, this is a very valuable thing to do. The problem with this particular calculation is that the resolution isn't very good for looking at globular cluster formation. There are two resolution scales here. One is the scale on which they smooth the gravitational potential, which is about a kiloparsec, so you can't say anything on spatial scales less than this. There's also a Lagrangian resolution scale of a few times 10 to the 8 solar masses in gas. That's basically because this is an SPH method, and in SPH you average, you determine all physical quantities by averaging over ensembles of 50 to 100 particles. So really in SPH your resolution limit is not your particle mass, it's 50 to 100 times your particle mass, and if you work that through for the Weil and Pudritz simulations, that comes out as a few times 10 to the 8. So that's why, as indeed Weil and Pudritz realised, they're not actually looking at globular cluster formation, they're looking at much larger scale objects. But what's interesting that it comes out of here is that, these are the mass spectra you get out. I've actually shown this is the mass spectrum of the dark matter clumps, but if I showed you the mass spectrum of the gas, it would be the same. And indeed, the reason for this is that the fluctuations in the dark matter generate the dominant potentials into which the baryons fall, and therefore the baryons are just their mass distribution is determined by the statistics of the dark matter's collapse. And this realization that when you look at either the baryons or the dark matter, you get the kind of power law slopes that people are used to looking at in globular clusters, came simultaneously from a number of authors coming to it from various directions. And then we have to ask, well, if this is relevant to globular cluster formation, and certainly this isn't established yet, then the fact that the globular cluster mass spectrum is the same as what you see in molecular clouds has to be fortuitous, because one thing we know for certain, the only thing we know for certain really, is that the spectrum of dark matter fluctuations has got nothing to do with what happens on the mass scale of molecular clouds. So the globular clusters are in a kind of interim position. You can make arguments one way or t'other that they've got something to do with this or something to do with what you see in molecular clouds, but you can't link this to the molecular cloud scale. Now, Sen extended this to looking at low-mass halos. This wasn't a numerical work, this is purely analytic. And he had this picture of gas sitting idly, as he put it, in low-mass halos, waiting to be compressed at the epoch of reionization, but at a redshift of about 7, reionization causing shock compression, collapse, and fragmentation of this gas that was sitting there before that, unable to collapse. I think that one of the main questions surrounding this scenario is whether or not the gas would indeed sit idly. You have to have a powerful field of photodissociating photons from population 3 stars bathing such low-mass halos in order to keep your molecular hydrogen from forming and stopping efficient cooling in these halos. And certainly the simulations that I'll be showing you in a minute, which are at sort of metallicities that you have for globular clusters, the gas is in no cases sitting idly. It is collapsing on a dynamical time without the need of waiting for an ionization shock to hit it. But I'm not ruling out that there wouldn't be regions of the universe or situations under which this kind of scenario could occur, however. So to finish up, we're talking about the simulations which have got closest so far to the globular cluster formation mass scale. And these are the simulations by Volker Brom and myself, and Volker will be talking about that in more detail in a few minutes. Let me just give you a bit of background. We're motivated to look at this problem from the Volker's results on the formation of population 3 galaxies. So let me stress, I'm not talking about globular cluster formation now, I'm talking about primordial gas, I'm talking about halos forming at z equals 20, 10 to the 6 solar mass halos. But I'm just showing you this in order to emphasize some aspect of the way that baryons and dark matter behave in these simulations. So this is just your initial conditions imprinted with your CDM fluctuations. What happens is that this whole mass scale in this simulation is about 10 to the 6 solar masses, but you get mini potential wells, smaller scale fluctuations in the dark matter, generating structure on a smaller scale. And you can't really see it particularly well in this plot, but the gas is starting to feel these small wells and be guided down into the bottoms of these dark matter mini fluctuations. And then following the violent relaxation of the halo, what you find in the simulation, and what Volker found, was that the dark matter is pretty smooth thereafter, but the baryons have fallen down these little mini potential wells, and you get baryonic clumps where the dark matter wells used to be. So you've got an efficient mechanism during violent relaxation, apparently for wiping out the substructure in the dark matter, but of course the gas being dissipative has collapsed down to much higher densities. It hasn't been scathed by this process, and it's now collapsing down, remembering where the dark matter had provided the moulds into which it fell. Now, of course, this wiping out of structure in the dark matter is very different from what people find on larger scale cosmological simulations, and it's still a bit of an open question whether, if you crank up the resolution, this result will go away, or whether you can ascribe it to the fact that it's a rather special cosmological regime. The spectrum of the power spectrum of fluctuations in this regime produces a mass variance which is very flat. In other words, what it means is that you're not strongly dominated to large power on relatively small scales. In this regime, where the slope of the power spectrum goes as k to the minus 3, all scales are more or less collapsing together. And that tends, we think, to lead to a more efficient wiping out of the substructure than what you get on larger scales, where the relatively smaller scales are collapsing well ahead of the large scales which fall down on top of them. So this is a conjecture to be followed through. But certainly in the small scale regime, it seems that the substructure in the dark matter goes away, and therefore what you're left with doesn't have dark matter halos. Now, these are not globular clusters. These are putative population 3 stars with masses of 1,000 solar masses or so. But one thing I thought would be interesting to simulate what would be a possible progenitor of a globular cluster system. Okay, I'm just winding up here. And what you find there is that indeed again, so what we're simulating here is a dwarf galaxy, a few times 10 to the 8 solar masses. The substructure in the dark matter is wiped out, but where the dark matter used to be, the baryons have fallen into clumps, and you get, these are the masses of the clumps. The resolution limit down at a few times 10 to the 4, 6 baryonic clumps going up to masses of a few times 10 to the 7 solar masses, which is a fair fraction of the total mass of the parent galaxy. Now, are these globular clusters, and if not, what are they? And so, I have to speed up a little bit here, but this is really this is where I link the simulations through to the questions we asked before. This is going to fragment. We can't say yet. The resolution scale that we get down to is only about 10 to the 4 solar masses, so we can't look at subfragmentation. I'm a bit concerned about it. I'm wondering whether the gas can really preserve its inhomogeneity on small scales enough to get fragmentation. I'm worried about the pressure effects damping out those fluctuations as the material falls into these dark halos. But at least we've never started off with a hydrostatically supported system here. The gas is always just dynamically following what the dark matter is doing and free falling down into these wells. We get them small and compact, and so this is good for maybe the efficiency arguments we talked about earlier. But again, resolution, we're getting down to the 10 parsec scale, obviously a lot better than the kiloparsec I was talking about a few minutes ago, but still uncomfortably small. The mass distribution, we've already said the statistics of the halos will give you the right mass distribution. We only produce 6 clumps. Our minimum clump mass is just our resolution limit. We might want to argue, though, that in fact smaller mass clumps couldn't form because the depth of the potential gets too shallow to be able to retain gas at 10 to the 4K, and therefore it's hard to see how such small potentials could guide the baryons down into them. The maximum mass in our simulation is a good fraction of the total baryon mass. So, you know, we started with a few times 10 to the 7 solar masses in gas, so of course, if you quite a lot of that turns up in the most massive object, you'll get about a 10 to the 7 maximum mass globular cluster. I'd say that this most massive object is not globular cluster-like. It's formed from the merger of a number of clusters over a timescale of about 10 to the 8 years. It's sitting down in the nucleus. You might say it could be a nucleus of a dwarf galaxy, but it wouldn't satisfy necessarily these constraints of efficient star formation and homogeneity, chemical homogeneity. I hope that very much that, since the discussion times are generous, Steve might let me put up two more bluegrass under the guise of getting the discussion going, because I think they're two big problems. What does set the maximum mass? Because I said that I think that Mike Falls made the argument quite persuasively that the intrinsic mass spectrum doesn't go much beyond 10 to the 7. In our simulations, it didn't go beyond 10 to the 7, but that was just because we started with a 10 to the 8 solar mass object. Well, you can argue it several ways. You can say that you pretty stop the process at reionization, because then gas is heated to 10 to the 4K and it can no longer fall into these little halos. And that therefore means that it doesn't really influence things thereafter, and therefore on a larger scale. That will intend to imprint it with a maximum mass. Or you can say, no, the process goes on fine, but what you get out of the process isn't what an observer would call a globular cluster. For example, here I'm just writing up again the stuff about the dependence of the mass variance on the CDM power spectrum. On larger scale, you may not get rid of the dark halo. You would produce objects with dark halos that you wouldn't characterize as globular clusters. Or alternatively, as you move to lower redshifts and more massive things, the effective dynamical time of the things you're forming goes up. And maybe as you get up to a longer dynamical time, we're in the regime where feedback can be efficient, and therefore it's not globular-like. The star formation is not efficient. The chemical signatures are not homogeneous. And this is the last view graph, which only has 1 point on it, 3 points. The metallicity problems. It works fine with putting 10 to the minus 2 solar masses sorry, 10 to the minus 2 in metallicity, this model, but also work fine at 10 to the minus 3. So we haven't really asked the question of why we don't get more POP 3-like globular cluster systems. We know that in dwarf spheroidals, there's a spread of metallicity between different globular clusters in that parent potential. These clusters are assembled over a time scale of about 10 to the 8 years, because that's the dynamical time of the parent dwarf. So conceivably, one could enrich the next, but this is something that one has to worry about. And finally, how do you explain the correlations between metallicity and the parent mass? That's just up there for discussion. Thank you.
Clusters form under only special circumstances. It's an observational fact that about 1% of the time you get a cluster. With present-day associations, they outnumber stable star clusters, open clusters, by about a factor of 100. The globular clusters are about 1% of the mass of the halo. So perhaps it's an accident, but in any case, I'd like to see some discussion about it too, differently. How would you?
I think red observations are now showing that all stars form 90%.
Yep.
So it's all at high efficiency when they're born, and very quickly they'll evaporate. So what you're saying about associations, that's the dispersal process. The formation process is always efficient.
But how do you combine 1% of the
cluster? Why does the dispersal process leave you with that kind of remnant? I don't know. No one has modeled dispersal that far. That's a 100 million year time scale for the dispersal of clusters. They leave a tight core, and then most of the mass leaves in the halo, and the IMF, the star explosions.
Perhaps I could chip in here. When you say that 100% is in clusters, that's clusters with a very large range of n, so we're not necessarily talking about n equals 10 to the 6. A lot of what people characterize as clustering in star-forming regions are clusters of 10 stars, 20 stars. You don't need to worry about dispersal mechanisms. You can have that 100% efficient, but they won't stay around just by pure slingshot gravitational dynamics. So in fact, you get rid of a lot of them just through that process, in fact.
Namely those where the star formation efficiency is very high. And that's also relevant to not only to the efficiency question, but also to the self-enrichment problem. You may not form those clusters, you may not have supernovae to pollute the cluster. And so the efficiency for globular cluster survival may only be 1%,
as the
ratio of halo stars to globular cluster stars.
And I think there are two things which make globular cluster formation likely to be more efficient than others. One is lower metallicity. The mechanical power in winds, for example, scales almost linearly with metallicity. So a low metallicity environment is kinder to efficient star formation than a population one environment. That's the first point. And the second point is the point I mentioned, that Ashman and Zepf mentioned, that if you get your gas up to high enough densities, you don't have to worry so much about the feedback and the inefficiency, because the free fall time is so short that it's all fallen into stars before they wake up to the fact that there are these feedback processes. So the qualitative level, there are two reasons which favour the efficiency in the globular clusters case.
In these kinds of mass spectra, there's equal mass in equal logarithmic intervals.
Mm-hmm.
And if the Gaussian globular cluster mass function started as a power law, it's got about half of the total number of logarithmic intervals that were there.
Mm-hmm.
So about the destruction of them has only been about equal in mass to what's left,
mm-hmm.
possibly a little bit more. By number, you're the factors of 10.
Sure.
And more involved. Mm. But it's not a huge amount of destruction in terms of mass to give today's population.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't fill a whole mm-hmm. halo with mm-hmm. loose stars, for example.
Sure.
It's not,
yeah,
not
sure.
that much mass.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I had a question. You mentioned that the spectrum of dark matter fluctuations is different than GMCs, so therefore, why a connection? But any hierarchical mass distribution, which means effectively a power law, power spectrum, will always give you m to the minus 2 as a mass spectrum of things that come out of it, just because there's equal mass and equal logarithmic interval. And it could be from turbulence or something else. It's a matter of...
I meant the physical, I meant the physical origin could be different.
The physics is different, but the end result could be the same.
Sure, I agree, yeah. But then the question is, the globular clusters, are they forming that way because of dark matter, or are they forming that way because of turbulence? That's still a valid question to ask.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, Kathy, I wanted to suggest something for this maximum massive clusters in your picture. That may be a statistical effect, I think. You can't have the thing that it's forming and be too big, because otherwise the crosstalk isn't going to wipe out the mini halos, right?
Well, that was one of my thoughts, yeah.
Right, so in that case, you know, if you've got a minus 2 power spectrum, the most massive cluster is going to be some fraction of the mass of the thing that it's forming in. I mean, that might do it, I think.
That's what I was really intending by that. But
yeah, okay.
That's right, yeah. You can't go too high up in mass or it doesn't work, yeah.
How much of a problem is it if globular clusters can't be self-enriched? Because you're pretty much forming the first structures, you're trying to form the first structures of the globular clusters, so what's producing the metals?
Well, I'm not saying they're the first structures, actually. I mean, I'm sure that Tom and Volker will talk about the first structures, which they might put back at much higher redshifts, but whether you can actually get it up to 10 to the minus 2 in the primordial gas.
Because it must predict some level of population 3, which it's at some level we must be able to constrain, too.
I agree.
I didn't realize this upper mass cutoff was a problem, because when Pudritz did the upper mass spectra, he got power loss. But if it's a problem, then I'll discuss in an hour or so an easy way out, and that is that the upper mass essentially comes from the available pressure. And in a turbulent medium, there's a log normal pressure distribution, which gives a pretty clear upper mass cutoff. And all lower masses would then follow by sampling from the fractal, but there should be an upper mass cutoff.
So you'd associate that with the virial pressure of the halo in which the thing formed.
Right, and then that would be the average pressure. And then the Gaussian width of this log normal depends on the Mach number.
So that will therefore, you could map that back and find out what was the host structure in which it formed, presumably. Because you get a different virial pressure for a dwarf than from the Milky Way. Yeah. What answer would you get then?
I don't know.
No.
Hasn't been included. I think this will be discussed more on Thursday.
Okay, so it'll be interesting.
There's no dynamical friction in the Jagan fault calculation, right? So, I mean, that's a nice way to get rid of the most massive ones. Just sink to the center.
Don't have to start really close to the center to sink in the whole time.
The dynamic friction depends on the mass ratio, right? It's true that if it was massive enough and far enough away, it would still be there. I think you're going to show some of that in your thing.
So you would...
You're going to have a lot of massive clusters in the inner region, so I have done some simulation on which I will show later during the conference, and it's a very nice way to get rid of a power law at the high mass state. So it's
you would argue it could be m to the minus 1.7 out to as big as you like.
I mean, I have some plots that show that you go from a power law to something more similar to the decay of a log normal simply by dynamical friction.
That makes every model much easier.
Yes. So I didn't worry too much about that discrepancy between the power law and the observed high mass state.
Other dynamically bound objects in the that we see is that they don't have a mass radius relation. And so if, for example, if you plot up the mass radius relation for all the virialized stellar systems we see, they're basically follow what you'd expect from the virial theorem, except globulars don't. And so this is either sets, it's not actually obvious how to get this from evolution, so it would seem to suggest it's something to do with the formation. It's actually similar to the old mass concentration relation that Jorgoski and Chernoff, I think, from maybe before that, found years ago. So there's and it may have something to do about which ones can survive, but there's details about how the stars get put into the cluster that then affect what we either we don't completely understand, it affect what we see today, and then have impacts both for what which ones survive, and also then impacts for how the stars are distributed for what we're talking about in a lot of the rest of the meeting. So half light radii versus mass, there's no correlation. It's a scatter plot. But you're not plotting tidal radius, right? You're plotting. Oh, well, that could be, but their tidal the tidal radius isn't supposed to say have that much to do with the half mass radius. I mean, well, no. So it might be just if you tidally maybe that's it, that they're tidally truncated, but it's also connected with the fact that the concentration is connected to the fact that they're that way. But you get this correlation with the mass and the concentration that's non-trivial.
Just a quick remark about this. When you compare globular clusters with other systems, such as galaxies, you've got to remember that it's only in the globular clusters that relaxation is an important phenomenon, and that has a very important effect on the half-mass radius and could very well scramble them in an accidental way and destroy any correlation.
Well, that would be related to the fact that you couldn't do a mass concentration relation for any other stellar system. But it ends up having, we don't really know where those come from. We have no ab initio model that gets from an initial distribution to a distribution like that. They don't start off as kinglets. They start off as something else and evolve.